I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. A Water Summit 2016 is taking place in Milwaukee next week, establishing a water-resilient city. It's on June 14 and 15, and there are going to be people in town from all over the world, from governments, water technology companies, universities, organizations and regions looking for water solutions, and many others will be in town. Milwaukee's become a leader in this whole area due to the university's facility on Lake Michigan and all the number of water companies that have been springing up in this area. We have two guests with us, water leaders. Charles Fishman is author of The Big Thirst, The Secret Life and Turbulent Future of Water. He works for the innovative business magazine Fast Company, and he's one of the most forceful, challenging, and inspiring public voices on water issues. Kevin Schaefer is also with us. Kevin is executive director of the Milwaukee Metropolitan Sewerage District. He is past president of the National Association of Clean Water Agencies. Thank you very much. Charles, thanks for being with us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Yeah, our pleasure. And Kevin, thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for asking.
Yeah, our pleasure. Charles, you have written that all water problems are solvable. We don't need a Manhattan Project or a new water-style Silicon Valley. We need to ask certain kinds of questions. Elected officials, water managers, and the public all need to look at their communities and ask, and what are the questions we need to ask? What do we have to look at?
Okay. We need to ask, how much water do we have, realistically, in a clear-eyed fashion, not wishful thinking? Like if you go to California right now, how much water do they really have? If you go to Kansas and you're actually taking seriously what's happening to the Oglala Aquifer, how much water do they have? In the Great Lakes, of course, we're blessed with abundant water resources, but we certainly need to keep in mind things like algae blooms. So question one is, how much water is there really? Question two is, how much water are we using? Question three is, are we using the water we're using smartly? Are there ways we could continue to do all the things we love to do, running vibrant communities and keeping the economy, you know, zooming along, but using less water? You're never sorry you use less water. The number, as just a tiny little example, the number one user of electricity in the United States of America is moving water.
Ooh.
So if you use a little less, you spend a little less on the power, you pollute the world a little less, and the water eventually ends up in Kevin's hands and has to be cleaned and returned to the environment. If you start out using less, you don't need to clean as much. So those are three really basic questions. I guess there's, in the context of what people are coming to Milwaukee next week to talk about, historically we haven't worried that much about any of those questions,
right,
in point of fact. And we end up with cities with one, sometimes two sources of water. They're not resilient. If something bad happens, we're in trouble. That's
mm-hmm.
why they had to turn off the water in Toledo. That's why Flint is in such a tough situation. So resilience in the context of water means having an array of ways of getting water and some flexibility in how you use it, the ability to throttle a little bit how much you need because you've thought about the situation you're in.
Mm-hmm. Kevin, do you want to add to that list and make it Milwaukee specific?
Yeah, and I think Charles really nailed it with those first three. But once you have the answers to those three, you then need to look at, you know, where does business, where does technology innovation come in? If we do have an undersupply of water, are there new efficient gadgets that can be developed to either move that water with less energy, use less water up front? And I think that really ties it to the Water Council and the Water Summit that's coming next week. We have the three basic questions, the quantity, the quality issues that Charles talked about. But then how do we adjust to that, and how do we use our know-how to really be more smart with the way we use water?
Mm-hmm. I know that there was a White House roundtable on water at the end of March as well, and there have been calls for cutting water by a third. It's interesting what Charles had to say. We don't hear about that very much at all, any kinds of calls to cut our water consumption. I remember back in the 70s when we were putting bricks in our toilets and things to use less water. It just doesn't seem to be on our national consciousness. Would you agree, and let's start with you on this, Kevin, that we do need to think about using less water and cutting water by a third is a good idea?
It's a great idea, and water really is the forgotten resource. It's something that we've learned over the years to that it's plentiful, so we just take advantage of it. We overuse it. So it really is forgotten, both in the resource itself and in the infrastructure that delivers that resource. You know, it takes a lot of pipes, a lot of treatment, a lot of engineering and chemistry and biology, really, to try to make that water that we bring out of the environment, treat it so that we can drink it, use it, and then put it back in the environment. And people need to understand that there's only a limited supply of water on the world, on the planet, and that the water that we're drinking today was used by someone else.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about what communities have to do, and you have written some really encouraging words that appeared in the New York Times, Charles, about what happened in California, what still needs to happen, but how they were able to get through a drought and did some pretty remarkable innovative technology as a result of living with drought for so many years.
Yeah, and let me take a half step back, Kathleen.
Sure.
The United States of America, as a country, uses less water today in 2016 than we did in 1970. Not per person, not per hour, not per dollar. As an entire nation, we have cut our water use over the last 46 years by about 10%. So the country has 60 million new people living in it. That's twice the size of California. It's basically California plus New York has been added since 1970. Even more remarkably, the economy is three times the size it was in 1970. So every gallon of water we use today does literally three times the economic work that it did in 1970. And most of us haven't actually noticed that the country has cut its water use. In other words, we don't walk around thinking, oh, I wish my lawn wasn't dead. I wish I could take a shower, but it's Tuesday and I don't get to take showers on Tuesday. We have done that in imaginative and innovative ways as a whole nation. So it is definitely possible to tackle these problems. Now, before we get to California, let me say that the big water users in the country are generating electric power. It is true both that water is the largest user of electric power and electric power is the largest user of water. The number one user of water in the country is making electricity, and the number two user of water, a close second, is agriculture. And the savings over the last 40 years have mostly come in those two big sectors. But household water use has also dropped on a per house basis. So we are learning to use less water even while we're moving forward. In California, you know, what they've done in the last 30 years is say, we use too much water. We don't live within our means. It's sort of like thinking about a retirement account or living off a savings account. If you withdraw too much and you don't put back any, eventually there's nothing left. And so California is home to a lot of water reuse, where the water that a city or a community has and has distributed for people to use for showers and cooking and flushing toilets and watering lawns is collected, and it's either, mostly in California, it's reused for non-potable uses, for things like landscaping and agriculture. But 30 years ago, there was very little of that. Now about 15% of all of California's water gets recycled. That's pretty impressive. 30 years ago, half the agricultural fields in California were flood irrigated. That is, you just poured water on the field, and it got to the plants, and it got to all kinds of things that weren't plants, That's not a very efficient way of watering thousands and thousands of acres of crops. Now, about a third of California fields are still flood irrigated, but 50% of the irrigated fields use micro irrigation, where the water goes literally right to the plant. That's not only a more efficient use of water, you use much less water. The plants actually do better with micro irrigation, so you get more food. So just a little taste. If you look at the statistics on California, if you look at the economic statistics, worst drought, the last 5 years, the worst drought in 1,000 years. If you only look at the economic statistics, you wouldn't even see it. California is growing gangbusters.
It's amazing. Let's talk about Milwaukee and Wisconsin. How do we fare, Kevin, when it comes to water reuse?
You know, that's one of the things we really need to work more on. Water reuse in our area is very difficult because a lot of what drives water reuse is the economics and the lack of water. As Charles said earlier, we've got an abundant supply of water, although in northern Wisconsin we still see periods of drought up in those areas. But with the Great Lakes and with that bountiful supply of water, trying to incentivize or create a recycle program for water is sometimes difficult. Now, there may be specific cases in certain areas, but it really is something that you need to try to implement on a large scale, and you need to try to get people to do it. And one of the ways you do that is through the financial models that would incentivize them to do it. In Milwaukee, we do offer low flush toilets, so that actually they're ultra low flush toilets, so they're even lower than what you might find at some hardware stores. But trying to show people that, you know, you can use the same toilet, you can use less water and have the same function with the different toilets, and so we offer a significant rebate on those. And, you know, I see that as a way to move forward. But I also think there's something called natural infrastructure or green infrastructure, where just the way we develop our region, the way we design our streets, our parking lots, our buildings, there's ways to utilize that water more wisely, and we incentivize that in Milwaukee as well, so that we are basically recycling some of that stormwater that, you know, 20 years ago probably just went into a street, down a pipe, and out to the lake, where now we're trying to capture that water and reuse it either on a green roof or a bioswale, or, you know, just try to bring nature back into our urban environment.
Mm-hmm. And how are we capturing that stormwater?
In a lot of ways with green infrastructure, it's a green roof. We'll capture 1 or 2 inches of rain, depending on how deep the soil is that you put on your roof.
Mm-hmm.
We sell rain barrels for a reduced amount, which is just a cistern that you put at the bottom of your downspout on your house, and that'll capture 55 gallons of water. Porous pavement is pavement that allows water to infiltrate through it as opposed to run off the surface. And that porous pavement has a storage mechanism to it as well. So there's different ways, and most people wouldn't even notice it. I'm sure driving around Madison, you're seeing some of these features, but you don't even realize the stormwater benefits that those features are providing. It just looks like a natural development.
Mm-hmm. And Charles, what about other communities in the country? Do you want to highlight any that are particularly innovative?
Oh, there's phenomenal countries or cities around the country. Philadelphia comes to mind immediately, Portland, Oregon, Los Angeles, New York, Washington, D.C.
Mm.
These are all major metropolitan areas, and especially out in L.A., you know, they've got the drought issues that they're facing. But trying to foster this more natural approach to managing that stormwater, because in a lot of cases it was just being sent to the ocean or to a river and going on downstream.
Mm-hmm.
Major municipalities around the country are definitely doing some great work. And I know next week at the summit, the head of Washington, D.C.'s D.C. Water is going to be a speaker. And then another speaker is someone that helped set up the New York system as well. So it's going to be a great conference.
Yeah. Charles, you want to chime in here about other innovations?
Oh, sure. Kevin reeled off a great list. If you flip it just for a minute, Florida is a perfect example of a place that that has, Florida is my home state. I grew up there. So before I insult them, let me just express my loyalty and affection for Florida. But 48 inches of rain fall on every square foot of Florida. Pick a plot of land, 48 inches of rain fall there, 4 feet. There's wow. more than enough water falling on Florida every year for the people and the farms of Florida. And here's what Florida does with that water. They collect it as efficiently and brutally as they can, put it into concrete culverts, and send it right into the Gulf of Mexico and the Atlantic Ocean. And then they pump the water they need up out of the ground from underneath the state. And those aquifers are so overpumped, they're pumped so hard, that they're contracting. And seawater is coming up into the freshwater aquifers under the state. And now they're having a big, basically, a statewide panic attack. What are we going to do about this salt water infiltrating our fresh water? And you look around, and every grocery store parking lot and shopping mall parking lot and school, they're collecting the water they need and throwing it away, and no one makes the connection. Mm. Like, wait a minute, we have the stuff we need falls free from the sky. So there are many places that are doing a brilliant job. I would add San Antonio. In fact, Orlando, Florida, has a huge reuse program. They send out every day exactly the same amount of potable drinking water and purple pipe reclaimed water. They reuse every gallon, and it has been illegal in Orlando for 30 years to water your lawn with drinking water if your home was built after 1985.
Oh.
So they have a whole generation of people who appreciate that you don't need purified drinking water to water your azaleas
right.
and your grass.
Right. No, you don't. So what makes Orlando at the forefront and other communities taking all the water and putting it back in the ocean?
Well, I'll tell you what. Kevin and I have a little bit of a mutual admiration society, but it's people like Kevin. It's smart water managers. The moment of insight they had in Orlando was literally back in 1982, 1983, the water planners looked at the growth curve for the city. Orlando has doubled in size in the last 30 years, and the amount of water available. The growth curve was going up to the right, and the amount of available water was drifting down because they were using it up. And somebody just said, this isn't sustainable. Why don't we use the water we've already got? And then you have to do a job of persuading the community, okay, if you're here already, we're not going to make you install a whole new plumbing system, but we're growing so fast. If you're laying plumbing for an office park or a school or a subdivision, laying a second set of irrigation pipes that are connected to the reuse supply doesn't cost a penny more than laying those pipes connected to the potable supply.
Mm-hmm.
And so they said, from this moment forward, we're going to make reuse water. We're going to take our wastewater. We're not going to throw it away. We're going to clean it. And every new bit of construction in this community is going to be required to use that reuse water. The most important thing is that doesn't change your water use patterns in a year or 2 years or 7 years. But 30 years down the road, those small changes, when you've doubled the size of your community,
sure.
they make a huge difference.
Yeah. Let's welcome phone calls for both of you. Next week in Milwaukee, June 14 and 15, a major water conference with people from all over the world. It's titled Building a Water Resilient City. And speaking at that are two people who are very prominent in this whole field. Charles Fishman, author and Fast Company contributor, 2016 Water Summit moderator. He is also the author of The Big Thirst, The Secret Life and Turbulent Future of Water. Kevin Schaefer, current board chair of the U.S. Water Alliance and Water Environment Reuse Foundation, as well as being the executive director of the Milwaukee Metropolitan Sewerage District. Phones are all ringing, so just keep the number in your head. We'll be with you as soon as we can. 800-486-8655. Email talk@wpr.org. Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show. We love to read your comments, and we're on Twitter @KDunnShow. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls now as we talk about Water Summit 2016, establishing a water-resilient city. This is taking place in Milwaukee next week, and Jackie in Milwaukee is our first caller. Hi, Jackie.
Hi. My question is, my understanding is a very sizable percentage of the water usage is due to loss from leaky pipes, and we know the issue with the lead pipes. Isn't a major solution to our water usage problem updating our infrastructure?
Kevin?
It absolutely is. And we need to go in and do that in a smart fashion so that we can integrate that replacement of pipe with maybe road repairs and so forth. It all comes down to trying to find the financing for that work. And that's really what Flint, it has highlighted the concern, but Flint is really kind of the canary in the tunnel telling us that, you know, we need to do more, we need to invest more, and we need to maintain that investment. It's not something that you just do and then forget about for 20 or 30 years. You need to go in and just properly maintain it. We do lose a significant amount of water across the country in drinking water and wastewater pipes. But trying to find the financing to repair this aging infrastructure and to keep up with it, that'll actually be one of the discussions at the conference next week.
I'm sure it will. What is the answer to that? It would cost an enormous amount of money, Charles, wouldn't it, to take care of all the cities in the country?
Yes. The simple answer is yes. Let me connect the dots for 1 minute back on the Orlando point. Just 1 second. The value you get in having, so Orlando has two water sources. They have their potable water source and they have their reuse water source. That's what resilience looks like. They've cut the amount of potable water they use per person in half, which gives them a cushion when they're, even Florida has droughts, you know, when the salt water comes creeping in, they've built some resilience in. In terms of Jackie's question, nationwide, here's the number. For every 7 days of water we supply to people in their homes, utility water, we lose a whole day's water. Mm. The leak rate nationwide is 14%.
Mm.
I've looked, and I don't see an easy place to find the leak rate for Milwaukee. Next week, we'll have the people in the room who can tell us. I bet it's better than 14%, just because Milwaukee's a little bit of an old city. Here's the problem. It's not as if the people who run water utilities aren't, you know, are stupid and that there's six big leaks and they're just sitting around with their feet up watching the dials and listening to the pumps. There aren't. They're in a city the size of Milwaukee or a city the size of Washington, there are hundreds of small leaks. And so fixing the leak problem means just what Kevin alluded to, ripping up roads and replacing water mains. The basic number is it costs $1 million a mile to replace municipal water mains.
Wow.
So you want to do that smartly, and you want to and people hate the disruption. And so you want to manage the conversation about it. Here's what we're doing. We want you to understand why we're doing it. You wouldn't use a phone that was 110 years old. We don't want you to drink out of a water main that's 110 years old either.
Right. Thanks, Jackie, for the call. Jim in Rice Lake. Hi.
Hi, Kathleen. I have a specific question for your panelists. I read that in California, and in fact all across the globe, that primarily for agricultural purposes, people and agricultural companies are drilling wells all the way down to the underground aquifer, for example, in California, to produce almonds, which are profitable and which are very water demanding. I also understand that this is happening in response to climate change all over the globe, particularly in places like India and China. And I've also read that this poses a serious global threat to water supply. Is my understanding inaccurate, or is this a real serious problem? I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks, Jim.
Jim's got every one of those pieces right. The reason the economy in California is thriving because they've done a lot of water smart things, but on the agricultural side, you know, it's the worst drought in 1,000 years. California literally produces 54% of the fruits and vegetables grown in the United States. 54% come from one state, a state having the worst drought in 1,000 years, and yet when you go to the supermarket, the price of watermelon, the price of romaine, the price of tomatoes, the price of strawberries, you wouldn't look at it and say, oh my goodness, there must be a terrible drought somewhere. And that's because farmers are making up the water that they are missing from the sky by pumping it up out of the ground. Here's how serious a problem it is. In some places in the Central Valley of California, the land is falling an inch a month or an inch every 8 weeks because the water is being removed and the land is crushing down into the empty space. That's ridiculous. That is not a sustainable solution for your $2.98 plastic box of strawberries. And California is moving to put in place rules that will manage groundwater. But groundwater is one of the most uncared for. If our water pipes and our water system is overlooked, groundwater is absolutely ignored. In lots of places in California, in lots of places in the High Plains, in the Oglala, the water levels are down 100 or 200 feet from what they were in the 70s. Imagine if the Great Lakes were down 100 feet.
People would be right.
Well, those aquifers are Great Lakes. They're just hidden. So it's an important problem.
Didn't you write that I read recently California passed a sweeping groundwater law, taking California from having the least regulated groundwater in the country to becoming a model, Charles?
Yes, that is exactly right. As in the modern phrase, it's a little weedsy, but yes, all of California is coming up under new rules that will require every community in California to have a sustainable groundwater plan. How are we going to make sure that the amount of groundwater this community uses, it's actually done by watershed, this watershed uses is not permanently depleting? How do we reinfuse water in the ground so that whatever level we're at now doesn't drop over time? But those rules come into force over literally, that's going to require transforming the way a lot of communities live and work and raise food, and so there's a 20-year time frame. Right now, the farmers are just pumping as hard as they can, and that's why your almonds and your pistachios are relatively affordable. It goes to a completely different issue, which is we know when there's a problem in the global oil market because the price of gasoline goes from $2.29 to $4.29, and as painful as it is for individuals, when the price of gasoline's at $4.29, we get more efficient cars. There's an incentive to insulate big buildings. Building codes are changed. Air conditioning and heating units get much more efficient. We find all kinds of ways of compensating for the $4.29 a gallon for $100 a barrel oil. We never change the price of water. And so in the middle of this terrible drought, farmers who can get at the water are doing everything they can to keep raising the food they've always raised because they're worried about their personal economic performance, not the long-term performance of water. And so price is an important problem with water in the city of Milwaukee, where you want to price it so people use it smartly, but much more broadly with the way water is managed across whole watershed.
And Kevin, do you have an idea of, let's look at the state of Wisconsin or maybe even the Midwest, do we have groundwater laws?
I don't know about laws. I don't really deal with groundwater in my day job, so I don't follow that as close, but I do know that we have a depletion of the aquifers in different areas of the state. So I do know that we've overpumped the aquifers in various locations, and southeast Wisconsin's one of them. The whole debate about the Waukesha water diversion is really driven by the low aquifer levels in Waukesha that everyone's been using over the years, and now they've reached a radium contamination concern, so they're, they're looking at a different source of water. I was just going to step back a little bit with what Charles was talking about as well. We have seen innovation driven in California by this drought that they're going through, they're living day to day. Orange County right now is taking their wastewater, treating it to a very clean level, and then injecting it back into the groundwater in an injection well. And then several miles away, they're pumping that water out and treating it for drinking water. So we're going to see more innovation, more technology, more approaches try to reuse that water. Again, this takes a lot of energy, though, so if you can bring it down to those personal choices that people make when it comes to water they use, foods they buy, just trying to target it more on wiser water use.
Mm-hmm. Mary in Milwaukee, hi.
Hello. Well, I have a 110-year-old idea I think we should go back to, and that's called a cistern. My house was built in the 1800s. It has one. It's been filled in, but if it wasn't, I'd be using it. And instead of having 55-gallon rain barrels, we could have 200, 300, 400-gallon rain barrels that you could actually use for watering your lawn, doing your laundry, washing your car, washing your floors. That would save lots and lots of water. So I think that's an idea we should go back to.
Mm. Charles, what do you think?
I mean, sure, she's right. The problem is economics. So in a place like Florida or a place like Wisconsin and the Great Lakes states, most of the time you get enough water from the sky to do the gardening you want to do, or there's a hose, and the cost of that water is so modest compared to the cost of installing a cistern in an existing home or installing one in a home you're building and maintaining a cistern over time. And so, again, there's economics plays a role here. Now, there are plenty of places where people are doing that. Just in the last 2 weeks in Denver, in all of Colorado, in fact, until 2 weeks ago, it was illegal to have any kind of rain barrel. It was illegal to collect in Denver the water that fell on your own house and property.
Really?
Because someone owned that water downstream on the Colorado River.
Yes.
And they just passed a law that said residents of Denver, people who own homes in Colorado, can collect the rainwater that falls on their own homes and use it. And in fact, the way they're using it, they're putting it back into the watershed anyway. So the law has always been a little behind the times. So there are places where it makes absolute sense, and certainly that would be hugely valuable in California. And again, it's a question of thinking ahead. Probably installing cisterns in a $150,000 new subdivision home doesn't cost that much at the moment that you build the home. But you have to think far enough ahead to plan for it. I will say that big institutions are doing a lot of this. So a place I happen to know off the top of my head, the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, a university with 50,000 students and faculty as big as a medium-sized city, in the last 10 years, they have retrofitted all of their athletic fields. So their big practice fields for football and baseball have huge cisterns under them, and all of those athletic fields are watered with rainwater. And when there's not enough rain, they use cleaned-up wastewater, the kind of water Kevin's plant gets cleaned and as a backup source. So it is a very smart idea, depending on both the geography and the scale you're talking about.
Right. You are really on top of your water news, Charles. you just
don't,
are.
Don't ask me about any place in particular, but if you raise a topic, I can give you an example that will answer your question.
You sure can. Let's go next to Jerry in Waukesha. Hi, Jerry.
Good afternoon. I had to step away from the radio when he was talking about Orlando, so possibly you touched on this already. I was out to Colorado on a trip last year and met a guy who said he was a hydrologist, and I had told him I had an idea, and I'm sure somebody else has this idea before me. Why couldn't we in a home gather our water that we use in the bathtub and shower and our dishwater that goes down the drain, somehow route it into a tank into the basement and then route that back up as our flush water in our toilets? And he said, well, it actually does. Somebody did come up with that. It actually exists. So I wonder, is that affordable to retrofit into an existing home? And then number two, quickly, maybe Kevin might be able to touch on this next week. I worked for a municipality, and our water departments would go out periodically into different parts of the city and flush the hydrants to make sure that, A, the fire hydrants were operational, and to be, B, I guess, to keep those dead ends on the hydrants from getting stagnant mm-hmm. fresh. But normally that water just ends up, you know, going down into the street. Well, our park and forestry guys in the summertime, they always have to go out and water brand-new planted trees and things like that to keep them from dying. So I was wondering, maybe Kevin might keep this in mind, that when they flush those hydrants, couldn't they possibly gather that into tanks on the back of trucks, try and keep that available for when they do need it a couple months later, and use that rather than just letting that hydrant water go down the drain.
Kevin.
Yeah, no, you're exactly right. And one of the most irritating things in my job is when I see...
Oops, hello.
Hello.
Yeah.
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. It just cut out for a second. Go ahead. Kevin? Hello, Kevin.
Hello. You still there?
Okay. Yeah, we're here. Go ahead.
I'm sorry. Flushing hydrants, they have to do...
Oh, I'm sorry. Your phone just... We'll have Scotty call you back, and then we'll put those questions on hold. Something's going on with the phone there, so please, I'm sure you'll remember what Jerry had to say, and we'll just be in touch with you in a second. Let's go on, though, to Pepin in Milwaukee. Hi, Pepin.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my question.
Sure.
My question is kind of... involves energy as well, and I've been reading about Lifter nuclear reactors, and what I don't understand is why we don't use that thorium, which exists practically everywhere. I mean, we could get the coal miners back to work almost instantly, just have them mining thorium, and then use that part of that energy to desalinate ocean water. I mean, we got enough water, it's just got salt in it, you know? And we could also use some of that energy to pull CO2 out of the sky.
No, Charles, you've written about desalination.
I have. I don't know anything about thorium nuclear reactors. But, Pappen, here's the problem with desal. In California, where water is much more expensive than in, for instance, the Great Lakes, what's called... California Water Project water, the water that moves from Northern California to L.A. and San Diego, costs about $800 an acre foot. An acre foot's a meaningless amount of water, but it's the amount of water that would supply two families for a year. The number to keep your eye on is $800. That's four or five times what the water in Milwaukee costs. So $800 an acre foot's already expensive water. In California, they just opened the largest desal plant in all of the United States, literally 2 months ago, 3 months ago. That water cost $2,200 an acre foot, three times what water moved from the north to the south costs, and 10 times what Great Lakes water costs. So now most of the cost is energy, but the plant in the plant that just opened in San Diego cost $1 billion. So people often look at the ocean and say, gosh, that's the solution. All of our water is desal water. The rain that falls on the Great Plains and even on the Great Lakes states is rain that evaporated off the Pacific Ocean.
Mm-hmm.
So it is desal water. What we need is a breakthrough in the technology of taking the salt out of the water. Today, the cost has come down to a quarter what it was. For $100 today, you can desalinate four times the water you could 40 years ago, but it's still three or four times more expensive than even pretty expensive water. So at the moment, desal is a supplement, but it's a very costly way of getting water, even in places that are right next to the ocean.
Thanks so much for your response. Let's go back to Kevin now and to the question about water hydrants and whether or not we can use the dishwater and the water from our baths to use it for flushing purposes. And then we lost Kevin, but now we have him back. Kevin,
I'm
it's
back
yours.
I apologize for that.
It's okay.
Problems on my end. So as far as reusing water, the bath water, the dishwater, and that in the house, it's actually against the state's plumbing code to do that.
Oh.
That is in Wisconsin, yeah. That is something that I really think we should look at to see if that could not be changed. I think that's something that would help the entire state, and it would be a component of trying to meet any saving money on our water bill or just meeting future needs for drought situations that we might face. But that is, that's something that I remember folks in the farm area where I grew up, they used to do that all the time. So that's an old idea, but it's a good idea. As far as the hydrants, they do flush them to make sure that they work and that. In my job, when it's raining real hard and you see people out there flushing hydrants, it just makes me scratch my head a little bit. But if we could capture that water and reuse it, I think that would be perfect. If we could locate green infrastructure near these hydrants, then that's a natural way to water that infrastructure to help make it more efficient when it's needed for stormwater management as well. So I just think that's one of those practices that we've done over the years, and we just need to learn new ways. And I think a lot of what we're talking about today can be solved with just change in personal habits.
Next week, Water Summit 2016, Establishing a Water Resilient City, taking place in Milwaukee, June 14 and 15, with people from all over the world. Two of the keynote speakers are joining us this hour: Charles Fishman, author and Fast Company contributor, the 2016 Water Summit moderator. He is the author of The Big Thirst, The Secret Life and Turbulent Future of Water. Kevin Schaefer is current board chair of the U.S. Water Alliance and Water Environment Reuse Foundation, as well as the executive director of the Milwaukee Metropolitan Sewerage District. More phone calls momentarily here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's go to Josie in Sheboygan next. Hi, Josie.
Hi. What I'm wondering is why it's legal to have those huge farms with all those poor animals where they use millions of tons of gallons of water to water those poor animals, and also why is it, I'm asking, why is it legal, and also fracking where they also use millions of gallons of water and they refuse to let the public know what the chemicals are that they insert in that water and into the ground. I just find it insane.
Charles.
Well, why is a hard question? It's legal because Americans like chicken at $2.79 a pound, and they like winter heating bills that are $100 a month or less, and they like gasoline at $2.29 a gallon. I think what's interesting to me is that it betrays a certain attitude, which is, when communities have tried to regulate the water around fracking, the natural resource companies say, we aren't going to pollute the water, but if you pass laws that say we can't pollute the water, then the economics of fracking don't make sense. So on the one hand, we won't. On the other hand, if you prohibit us from tainting the water, then we're going to walk away. Well, the problem in that conversation is the value of the clean water isn't included. All that's being included in the calculation is the value of clean, in this case, cheap natural gas. The water's free, so why are we worried about it? And again, there's a little bit of an economics issue there. Historically, in America, farmers pay nothing or very little for their water. All those California farmers who are pumping furiously to grow the food that we rely on, but also pistachios and almonds and so forth that are being exported, they not only don't pay a dime for most of the water, they aren't even required to keep track of how much water they use. Even the requirement to just tell us how much water the pistachio trees are using isn't in place. So there's a huge culture change that has to be put in place if we're going to hold people responsible. But Josie's point is great. In a pig farm, a pig, to put it bluntly, a pig poops exactly the same amount as a person. So if you've got a pig farm with 30,000 pigs, livestock operation with 30,000 pigs, it's just like having a city of 30,000 people, but there's no waste treatment requirement. There's no Kevin Schaefer for the pig farms.
Right.
And the result is a mess for our environment.
Kevin, do you need to expand your business?
I was wondering if I was going to take a pig.
Now, there's a revenue opportunity.
Exactly.
I can say to that last caller, in the Wisconsin area, we have these confined animal feed operations, and I think that's what she's referring to, where there's
cattle
that are raised in very confined areas. There are, depending on the number of cattle that are in these farms, there are limits placed on the water quality that comes off of those facilities. So the DNR and the EPA are watching the water quality impacts. It's for those very large farms. Some of the smaller ones, I can't remember the size that it has to be. I think it's 1,000 head or something like that. But if it's these smaller farms that have these operations, there are no real regulations.
Mm-hmm. What about the fracking, Charles?
I think the fracking equation is really, really simple. I think fracking's great. I think we appreciate the inexpensive natural gas. We've been struggling for 30 or 40 years, really since the mid-70s with President Carter, to find a way of achieving a certain amount of energy independence. But fracking's only great if you can protect the water. If you have to destroy the water in that community to get at the cheap natural gas, then we don't need the cheap natural gas, and we don't need the resulting really expensive water mess. So to me, the two should absolutely go hand in hand. If you want to go down there and use water to get at that natural gas, which many of us depend on, you have to do it in a way that protects the water supply. If you then say, that doesn't make any economic sense, then the answer is, oh, well. You know, we wouldn't let you build a oil refinery in the middle of downtown Milwaukee. We would say we need oil refineries. But downtown Milwaukee's not the place, and this is exactly the same. If you can't keep the water clean, then we'll just let the natural gas stay where it is.
Thanks, Joseph.
That is not the universal view of how to manage fracking.
Right. No, I'm sure it's not. Josie, thanks very much for the call. Let's just talk. We only have a couple minutes left. I want to hear more about this conference. Who all's coming to this? What are you most excited about when it comes to the water conference in Milwaukee next week? Kevin?
Well, I'm excited about sitting on a panel with Charles because I'm going to sit there and listen to him. He's great.
You both are, actually. You've been great guests.
No. I think the thing that the Water Council's Water Summit does is it brings around the experts from around the world, and it brings them together in one spot so you can start talking about solutions to these tough questions that we've been talking about for the last hour. So I think having the New Yorks, the Washington, D.C.s, the San Diegos, all these different folks coming to Milwaukee and, you know, just coming to little old Milwaukee to talk about water.
Mm-hmm.
I think that shows the power of the summit, the need for the summit. And it's just going to be a great frolic because we're going to learn so many new things, and it's just going to be a great learning experience for me. And I'm really excited about being part of it.
And Charles, for you?
Well, I mean, look, the head of water in San Diego, who just built that billion-dollar desal plant, she's going to be in Milwaukee next week. The head of water where I live, here in Washington, D.C., George Hawkins, is a legendary character in the world of water. He's only been the head of a water utility for, I think, 7 years, but he has become one of the great innovators, not just in the U.S., but around the world. So impressive a performance in Washington, D.C. in the last 7 years that his water utility is now creating a consulting division to help small water utilities do what he does.
Huh.
And no offense to the big boys, he's going to charge less than the big consulting companies. He's going to make a little bit of money, and he's going to help improve water, small water systems worldwide. The folks from San Antonio are coming. And from New York City, a guy who ran the water system in New York City. So, you know, what I sometimes say to people is something that you alluded to, Kathleen. Every single water problem in the world has been solved. There's only 23 of them, or maybe there's 32 of them. I haven't actually ever made a list and counted them.
But every single water problem has a solution. There is nothing we don't know how to fix. And so when you bring this community, you know, there's 20 people on panels across.
We only have 10 seconds left.
When you bring those people in, you hear how they solve their problem.
Right.
You can go home and solve yours.
Absolutely.
Exactly the same way.
Thank you both so much for the hour. It was fascinating. Charles, thanks.
My pleasure.
Kevin, thank you.
Thank you.
Charles Fishman is author and Fast Company contributor. He's the Water Summit moderator. He's author of The Big Thirst. And we also thank Kevin Schaefer, current board chair of the U.S. Water Alliance. Thanks to K.P. Whaley for producing the hour. Scotty Myers for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee, close to the lake.